You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 26th of October 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show,
we urge the government of Iran to stop harassing the employees and the families of employees of the BBC Persian service, as well as other journalists. And I would say it's a very, very serious concern to us.
So says the UN Special Rapporteur on freedom of opinion and expression. But how much can the organisation do to protect journalists covering Iran? My guests, Somnath Batabayel and Michael Binion, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including Qatar has announced plans to introduce a minimum wage. We ask if it's a genuine change or an empty gesture. Turbulence in the US aviation industry as new security checks are introduced and American Airlines is accused of racism. Plus, a first-hand account of an encounter with a 186-year-old gay tortoise. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. I promise the story of the tortoise will be explained at the end. It's more interesting than that, I guarantee you. Anyway, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Somnath Batabayel, lecturer in Media and Development and International Journalism at SOAS, and Michael Binion, Foreign Affairs Specialist for The Times. Welcome both to the programme. We're going to begin today by heading to Qatar. The country has announced plans to introduce a minimum wage for the first time. The move comes the day before a meeting of the UN's International Labour Organization, which had warned Qatar to end the abuse of migrant workers. The country has faced criticism for its harsh treatment of its migrant workforce, estimated to number between 1 and 2 million people. Many of them are engaged in the construction projects ahead of the 2022 Football World Cup. Michael, they'd already said that they were going to change some labour laws, and coming with this minimum wage is also the promise that they will make the contract between the state and the employer rather than private companies. So it means that people who are unhappy will be able to return home. First of all, the nature of the change. Do you think it's a fundamental change?
If they put it into effect, yes. But that's the question. I mean, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. We have to see that these workers are treated fairly, because the situation up to now has been appalling. More than 1,000 people have died in accidents of one kind or another. Well, any country that has an accident rate of that kind on a construction project should certainly be examining its own record and seeing whether it's treating its workers properly. And secondly, I think it is obviously a sort of cosmetic change, because they know they're under pressure. And it's particularly important for the subcontinent, where most of the workers are coming from and where they've had very little chance to protest against their conditions.
Now, some countries have already been saying to their people, be wary of travelling to the region and be cautious, because you could end up almost like indentured labour. But have numbers dwindled going there, or is the poverty in Southeast Asia such as it is, or Southern Asia rather, that people have continued just to go?
Well, people have continued, because although the conditions are pretty awful, the fact is the rewards for some are very great, even on a rather pitiful wage. Qatar is an immensely rich country. I mean, it has very few of its own citizens. It has huge reserves of gas, particularly. It's making a lot of money, one of the, I think, the richest country per head in the world. And frankly, it's a disgrace that this situation has arisen. If conditions improve, then maybe more will come. I think the problem has been that, of course, there are so many wanting a share of the pie, that if they open the doors, I mean, millions would flood in. And they do have to keep a fairly strict control of who comes in and whether the visas are extendable or not.
Somnath, what makes us queasy about this? Because, let's face it, many people around the world are paid terrible salaries and terrible wages. These people, is it because they're building, you know, for example, stadia that will be used for a World Cup, that, you know, the West that travellers from around the world will use? Is it the disparity that is so shocking here?
Indeed. I mean, and as Michael points out, and you said, that most of the construction workers come from poorer countries, much poorer countries. And I've seen this in India and reporting in it from India. People who go, who sell their lands, have nowhere to come back to. So they, as you, indentured labor is the word. You've used the term I would have said, and the proof will be in the eating of the pudding, because the execution of the government's orders will be run by government officials. Now, since the 1970s, since the oil boom, and that's when construction workers, workers of all sorts, started to come in into the GCC countries, including Qatar, the government had a very hostile attention on these workers. So we have grown up, they have grown up with the understanding that work, expatriate workers are generally a threat, not only to the economy. In 2004, they said they're a threat to the country's integrity. So to dismantle about 40, 45 years of hegemonic state thought will be the problem, because government orders will have to be carried out by people who have been ingrained into believing that workers are necessary, but they're evil. And this has grown even further since the 2000s, when the nationals, Qatari nationals, started finding it difficult to get the plum jobs they were promised before.
That question of the jobs is also come up in an interesting way about the question of women drivers in Saudi. I saw one report saying that, you know, part of the reason for allowing women to drive was because many women currently have drivers, often men who've come from South Asia, for example, who are their drivers. And Saudi's keen to get a whole number of these people out of the country. Mm-hmm. So letting women drive means that the driver class can go, maybe some of the taxi drivers can go, that they can begin to be a little bit more independent. Do you think, Somnath, that these countries are cautious of the huge numbers of migrants in their countries, often putting them at a very small minority position?
Well, I mean, the last proper census taken was perhaps in 2004, and about 70% of the population is from outside, in the GCC countries. So that's a huge number. So yes, there is I'm sure problems of identity, national identity, does creep in. The governments in most of these countries have tried the rotational policies to let workers come in for a certain amount of time and then they have to leave. But it has never worked because of the necessity of a huge workforce. The Gulf countries do not have that. So since the oil boom, they have had to have a large expat population to work that. So pushing out drivers or a particular occupation for a bit of time, maybe it'll be a small plaster. I think on a to have a long-term solution to this problem, all the countries in the GCC have to change their official ideology towards expat workers and how they're handled. If that is not done, this will only be plasters.
Mike, one of the nice things is this is a bit of victory for good old-fashioned journalism and good old-fashioned labour organisations to put pressure on Qatar. They have bowed to, you know, international jabbing at their kind of their reputation on this.
Well, indeed, yes. But I have to say that I think they've probably been tipped off and prompted in large measure by Saudi Arabia, which, of course, it does itself have these same problems. And it does also treat migrant workers fairly poorly. They know that they need a policy of Saudiization and all that. It's their problem, too. But at the moment, they're having a massive row with Qatar. And they are very happy to see Qatar rather in the spotlight in an unsavoury way, because they are trying to isolate Qatar among the Gulf countries. They accuse Qatar of supporting Islamist extremism, and basically they feel Qatar is not really paying respect to Saudi Arabia as a smaller country. They should do. So I think they have been very happy to let the blame internationally fall on Qatar. There's not much solidarity there, but it is certainly true that the press has been writing about this some time.
In reverse, do you think for the Qataris, this is a good piece of PR at a time that lets them say, actually, we're not like the Saudis, we're not like our neighbours down the Gulf, we're doing the right thing. Look at us, we're the more modern country here.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's obviously their aim. In fact, they don't have nearly as good a record as just down the road. The one country that has treated migrant workers pretty well is Oman. where they have a very different attitude, where they've always had limited contracts so that you don't get people being sort of touted around after one visa expires, they try to find another employer. It's fairly clear from the start, where they've paid them a better wage, and where, interestingly, they don't let anyone except Omanis be taxi drivers. That's the one key thing, because they say, who is the first person that a foreign visitor meets in a country? It's the taxi driver from the airport, and we want our people to be the ones they meet.
And Somnath, no hint yet what this minimum wage is going to be. So again, that proof, we need to see what that is, don't we, before we can judge the quality of this arrangement.
Indeed. I mean, this at the moment, this is a good PR exercise which has started after 1,200 migrants have died.
Well, sticking with the theme of UN interventionism, let's head to Iran now. David Kay, the UN's special rapporteur on freedom of opinion and expression, has urged Iran's government to stop harassing BBC Persian staff and their families. The BBC complained after Iran initiated a criminal investigation into 150 current and former staff and contributors for conspiracy against national security. So let's start with you on this. What is the problem here? Why are the Iranians concerned?
Well, this is not a new problem. I mean, and post-2009, after the elections, when Iran accused foreign media and foreign governments of interference, they have gone after the journalists. I think after 2013, there was a bit of a dip in this once Rouhani came on power, and you know, it seemed to have calmed down slightly. But in the last couple of years, I mean, I immediately can think of Shirani, who had to flee the country after she complained of a sexual assault. Journalists of Radio Farda have complained. I think, if I remember correctly, the director, Arman Mustafi, has said that four of his workers has received over 10 death threats in a space of over 3 months. So this has been a continuing one. The families of journalists are always vulnerable targets because it's the softest one. And again, in the capital, it had lessened a bit, but it had moved out to the provinces. Families in provinces were being targeted. So this has been, again, a long tradition where Iran has targeted journalists and their families. It now comes to the forefront when a top news organization finally speaks out and speaks out very strongly. So hopefully a lot of attention will come down. There'll be a lot of pressure on Iran to rectify.
Michael, the Iranians seem to associate the BBC with the government here, and they don't seem to see much difference between the two. While in London we may think of the BBC as this impartial organisation, is that part of the problem, that they are seen as representative of a government which in the past has meddled in Iranian affairs?
Absolutely, yes. Britain is always seen as the real bogeyman in Iran. They have long memories. They've never forgotten the fact that the overthrowing of Mossadegh in the early 50s was largely instigated by British intelligence, and the Iranians always think that Britain is the sort of master manipulator in the region. I mean, America, of course, has been the more obvious target recently, but in every Iranian's mind, it's really the scheming British, in their view, who are responsible for all difficulties and troubles that Iran experiences. And they see the BBC as the voice of the government. It doesn't matter how many times people say, well, it's independent, nobody believes that. And I have to say, it's not just Iran. I mean, places like Russia and other places, they still think the BBC is the official voice of the government. And the reason they hate it so much is because the BBC does a very thorough job in reporting what goes on in Iran. And in particular, not only does it give them news that is banned or suppressed in Iran, it actually throws a spotlight on the very big divisions, political divisions, within the top echelons of the Iranian government, and in particular the struggle between moderates and the hardliners. And the ones that don't like it are the hardliners. So they're really going after any foreign news sources which are widely listened to, and the BBC is clandestinely widely listened to.
And we should explain that the majority of these journalists are sitting outside of Iran. It's their families often who
Absolutely.
Are being hassled. It's like kind of old
hostages.
Yeah, but hostages are almost like the old Soviet Union, where you'd bother a family member to try and control somebody who is living abroad.
I think that's despicable. It's despicable. I can understand that they really hate the journalists and they would say, we'll never let you back, and you're unwelcome. But to go after their families is really despicable.
I mean, parents are taken off in the middle of the night by Secret Service agents. You know, they can't sell their properties. They can't sell cars. Spouses coming in, passports are retained. I mean, really. But it's not. I mean, the point also is that it's not only journalists who live outside. Journalists now write under pseudonyms in Tehran. They have websites where they put up stories about the government, but under different names. It's a very hard-working atmosphere, very hard work, that place.
And, of course, I think they must be particularly concerned because nowadays it's much more difficult to control. Just as you said, with people writing under different names, but also social media, however much you try to cut out the ability to receive social media, it gets through and people do read it.
But also just the number of flights coming out of Tehran, the number of people who go back and forth to see their families. It's not like in the 70s or 80s where people who had been associated with the former regime stood aside and didn't go back. There is a much more kind of shuttling of people and information. It's quite hard to either of you to shut down that now.
That's, I mean, true. But having said that, you know, despite the kind of avenues of producing information, the intimidation which goes on, I mean, the gentleman I know personally, Mehdi Ghazali, who used to run a blog called Baran, and who was one of the prime sources of journalists in the BBC and in the US, has been arrested last month. So in one sense, yes, you have more avenues of information getting out, but that doesn't take away in any way the state intimidation which goes on for journalists and bloggers.
Well, we shall watch the story over the coming days. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Somnath Batabiel, and also Michael Binion. Coming up after the break, American aviation updates and a gay tortoise.
Subscribe today to become part of the Monocle family. From product design to the best places to go, Monocle will bring a monthly dose of fresh ideas to your door. Being part of the family also comes with a 10% discount at the shop and online, as well as unlimited access to our online archive. In addition, you will enjoy priority access to selected product collaborations and receive exclusive offers and invitations around the world. Subscriptions start from £55. For more information, visit monocle.com/subscribe.
Just grow like a tree with the roots very deep on earth.
For the best in food and hospitality, tune into The Menu.
I learned that from a potato farmer way up in northern Maine. And he baked me a potato, and it was like eating the best thing ever.
Monocle's program on food and drink introduces you to the most inspirational chefs, dedicated producers, and innovative restaurateurs.
Some cinnamon syrup, a half an ounce of that. Got our Bosca Schnapps, an ounce of this.
So when you need inspiration for your dinner plans or want to find a new place for a superb cocktail, tune into The Menu with me, Marcus Hippie, premiering every Friday at 1900 London time.
It was really the River Cafe where I really just had a deep relationship with carrots. Vegetables, sorry, I said to say carrots, but I love carrots, so I meant vegetables in general.
Well, welcome back to Midori House, and still with me are Somnath Batabiel and Michael Binion. Well, it's been a turbulent couple of days in US aviation. Yesterday, NACAP, the civil rights organisation, issued a travel warning advising black travellers to avoid flying on American airlines, citing a pattern of disturbing incidents reported by African American passengers. And today, the Department of Homeland Security announced new security measures affecting flights into the US, including the enhanced screening of passengers and electronic devices. Let's start, first of all, with this story about American Airlines. It's quite hard to pick it all completely apart. But there's, Michael, is it more at the moment a sense that something is going wrong rather than definitive proof? But there has been a warning about the risks for non-white travellers.
Yes, I'm not really convinced by this one. Yes, there have been incidents, three or four, and some of them rather unpleasant. But, I mean, they are incidents it's almost impossible to prove. This is either a policy of racial discrimination or deliberate prejudice against ethnic minority groups, particularly black people in America. For example, there was somebody who was bumped off a seat. One white woman wasn't bumped off and a black woman was bumped off. And that was taken as a deliberate proof that this was discrimination against black people in the States. Well, it could be that they just tossed a coin and one was bumped off and one wasn't. You know, one doesn't know. And there have been several other minor incidents. I wouldn't say major issues of discrimination. And I do think at the moment the National Association, NACAP, has been very, very oversensitive. It's part of the general climate in America, looking to take offence where possible. There are sometimes justified causes for outrage, but in places such as university campuses and things, it's almost impossible now for anyone to do anything without someone feeling aggrieved and taking offence. And they've picked on American Airlines, I think possibly as an example, saying this is a company that is not sensitive enough to concerns of black people. And they are trying to point the fingers. And of course, the only answer from the American Airlines is an enormous apology, our fault, we'll do better, and things of that kind. And let's hope they do.
Somnath, is kind of, as Michael says, it comes at a really interesting time. We obviously have Donald Trump in the presidency, whose views on race seem hard to pin down. We've had the terrible demonstrations in Charlotte. We know that the Black Lives Matter campaign has been really important for challenging what's happening about policing. And there is this very heightened sense. Now, when it comes down to this American Airlines story, you know, it's not trivial in comparison. If there is institutional racism that involves more black people, then it really does need to be looked at. But when it comes down to some of these individual incidents, do you think there is a risk that you can become too sensitive before hearing the evidence?
It's, as a brown person, it's difficult to take a theoretical stance to this, having been taken off too many cues at too many times. So I don't know. But I wouldn't be able to answer that objectively, just given the fact that I refuse to go to America and haven't gone to America for many, many years just because of this one problem. But this also must be seen. I understand the concerns that one can be politically too sensitive. But the last few years, the kind of abuse, hatred, police violence, which American blacks have been subjected to, out of which comes a lot of these movements. It's in that context. Maybe this particular incident here or there cannot lead us to a grand narrative, but it's in a larger context of discrimination for a very long time. Having said this, I take Michael's point that it's too early to point fingers that quickly and use big words like racism.
Because also the alternative, Michael, for the airlines is, you know, let's cover our backs here and let's make sure it's not a black person that we take off ever, because then we won't be seen to be doing wrong. And that again is not a solution. That is just embedding another issue. You just need to have policies which are proven to be equal in their treatment of people, don't you?
Exactly. And it's not just policies, it's mentality, it's mindset. And it's, if you lean over backwards, then you provoke a counter-narrative, you provoke a backlash, you provoke angry whites who say, well, of course, they get favouritised. And that's the danger, for example, of what they call positive discrimination. I mean, affirmative action, I think, is the American term, where if there's a job coming up, if a black person applies, they are given affirmative preference over a white applicant. Now, a lot of that has proven to be quite disastrous, because it has led to resentment, and it's also led to a kind of demeaning in the sense that people say, oh, they only got the job because of their skin colour, which is a terrible situation. You don't want that at all. That's even more racist than you know, being difficult about awarding a job. So I think people just have to have an equal mentality, and that all comes down to education, better kind of citizenship, and an end to years and years of prejudice, which, as Somnath said, I'm afraid is still embedded in America in a way that we're surprised to hear.
But Michael, I mean, if I may, you point out to a public mentality of, you know, things which can get embedded. And in this security measures which American Airlines and airlines all over the world are being asked to take when they fly into America, and for me, one of the main issues was labor. You know, you are asking untrained people in airlines to do security checks. Mm, and, yep. and, and This is almost impossible. I mean, forget the work pressures, forget the low pay, but you don't know. You simply have no idea of security, what intelligence officials and agencies bring. Airlines officials cannot. And that's why mishaps like this happen, which the airlines is facing right now.
Yeah, as somebody, you know, you describe yourself as brown skin, but...
Thick brown skin.
Okay.
Very elegant brown skin.
are you living in a sensitized world where, you know, you're cautious of you know, when things go wrong like that, you know, do you naturally have a question in your mind, I wonder why that happened to me? You know, and not wrongly, you know, I wonder whether... You know, it's the same at the moment with the Me Too campaign. It's unleashed a lot of people saying, look, you know, there's all minor things I've put up with in the past. Actually, they seem trivial to you, but I want to raise them to a kind of different level. Do you think that the question about racism is becoming a little more easy to express the debate and say, actually, let's just, before we move on from this, as just, you know, a random incident, have a question about it?
Andrew, it's such a large meta-existential question.
I don't know how one takes this up. That's why you're here, because you're good at doing it in 20 seconds.
I think, you know, I've been in England as a student, and then I work here at the university since 2003. And until Brexit happened, I have almost never had a situation, except for one drunk man very early, which you can dismiss anywhere. And I come from a country which is extremely racist. So, it's, you know, I understand racism in different ways. India is a very racist country. So, until Brexit and this hyper-nationalism happened in England, I have really never questioned my stay here. Post-Brexit, explaining to myself why I'm here and why I should continue to be here, though I'm married to a native English woman and I have a child who's British, that becomes more difficult. So I don't know if it puts questions of racism, it makes it easier to put, but it has come to the forefront as a personal experience. I don't want to draw a grand theory out of it, because you are asking a very personal question to which I'm responding, not in 20 seconds, but 40.
Well, you did very well, but as a 3-second rejoinder, I would say that there's quite a few white British people here wondering what they're doing here as well, post-Brexit. But that's another question. Finally, we did promise you a gay tortoise, and he's kind of slowly ambling into the corner of the story lineup, because... On a giant gay tortoise, who is the oldest resident of the island of St. Helena, made headlines last week when he came out of the closet, or at least his shell, aged 186. More precisely, it was discovered that Frederica, a giant fellow tortoise, introduced to the island 26 years ago as a mate for Jonathan, is in fact a male. Now, Michael, there's so many layers of this story. But in the background is the fact that there's this island that's going to be voting actually on gay rights, on the right to marry.
Yeah, same sex marriage.
And they kind of seem to have latched onto these two tortoises as some kind of like a
odd
example of what can go wrong.
It was a bit of naughtiness on my part that I was the first one to come along with this, because everybody knows about Jonathan, the most famous resident on St. Helena, which is, don't forget...
Aren't many others, are there?
Well, it's a very, very remote British Overseas Territory. It's a marvellous place, but it is way out in the middle of the Atlantic, and that it's so remote that that's where they sent Napoleon into exile, and that's all that most people know about the island. They know about Napoleon, and they also know that it does have this giant tortoise that is probably the oldest living creature in the world, certainly on land, and it is lives on the plantation, on the lawn of the governor's house. And it is, I mean, when it was in its youth, it was being a bit frisky when it was about 110 or so. It was sort of knocking over, you know, bowls, hoops for croquet and things. And they thought that it was just lonely, and they brought this other tortoise along. In fact, they brought several along, but it took an instant fancy to Frederica. And even at this ripe old age, its ardour isn't dimmed, so it still attempts to mate her once a week. Making a terrible noise as it does so. Now, the hapless Frederica's damaged her shell recently, and the vet, who has to look after this famous resident and looks at her once a week, did a really close examination when patching up the shell and said, well, actually, you know, it's not...
We're getting the picture.
We're not absolutely clear that it's a female tortoise. It could be a male. Now, it's not definite that it's a male tortoise, but the idea that, you know, poor old Jonathan has been having a go at Frederick all these years has caused enormous amusement.
Well, who says nothing happens on St. Helena? Well, we do actually. That brings us to the end of today's show at a very nice slow pace. Somnath Battabayal and Michael Binion, thank you very much for joining us on Midori House. Today's show was produced by Henry Rees-Sheridan. It was researched by Fernando Acosta Pacheco and also by Alessio Delania. And our studio manager, well, that was Christy Evans. There's more music next than at 1900 hours. It's The Urbanist. That's with me, Andrew Tuck, and we'll be reporting from City Lab in Paris. And we'll have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200 hours. Midori House is back at the very same time tomorrow, of course, as 1800 hours London time. But from me, Andrew Tuck, goodbye.